Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Kathleen Dunn Show here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Architects and urban planners have been forced to, well, think about our built environment, if you want to call it that, in new ways in the wake of things like population density and climate change. This has led to an emerging discipline of design called arcology, which is sort of a, oh, I don't know, in a way a linguistic trick. It's a combination of the terms architecture and ecology. It's a habitat concept that has long appeared in science fiction novels, but could it be a real solution for future cities? Well, that's what we had planned on talking about this hour. However, neither one of the guests we had scheduled is answering the phone. So, every talk show host's worst nightmare. I would say this, and here's kind of a we'll pull aside the curtain and reveal how sometimes topics become shows. As I was preparing to host the Kathleen Dunn Show, of course, the producers KP Whaley and Scotty Myers asked me, "Well, what would you like to talk about?" And it just so happened that I was reading a book called Count Zero, which is the second book in William Gibson's Sprawl trilogy. And I ran across a term called arcology, and it was used to refer to this giant high-rise and how self-sufficient it was. And so that made me curious, and I started to do some research, and I discovered this thing, and I said, wow, what a fascinating concept. And guess what? They're building these things. There's a number of them under construction all over the world. And one architect who pioneered this back in, started one in 1970, and it's out in Arizona, about 70 miles north of Phoenix. And we're hopefully going to talk about that this hour, if we can find a guest. So a fascinating topic. But the idea is that you would build these would be kind of little self-sufficient, densely populated structures or constructions that would be entirely self-sufficient. And by that, I mean energy, food, water, all the resources, waste management, all of those things. And so they would be able to combine high population density with a small ecological footprint. So that's what we're going to talk about this hour, I hope. We'll see if we can take this out of science fiction novels and put it in the real world. And of course, there are a lot of designs sitting out there. A lot of people have spent a lot of time doing research on this. And as we say, there's one in Arizona that was started in 1970. They're still building it. And there are others in other parts of the world, including one in Moscow. There is, I believe there's, let's see, where else are they? They're all over the place. And there's at least five of them being built outside the United States as people look for alternatives to what we're doing now, which some people say isn't working. And we need, in order to be sustainable in the long run and to deal with some of the things that are in front of us, we need to take a look at something like arcology. So wondering what you might think about that, as long as we're waiting for the guests to be on with us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. And you can join us on Facebook. The Kathleen Dunn Show has a Facebook page, and you can post something there. What do you know about arcology? Is this something that you think could help us out? If you take a look at where we are in cities, there's a lot of the pieces of this are already in place. People are growing food in cities and doing all sorts of other things. Is that maybe the first step toward creating these arcologies that would perhaps help us to create more sustainable communities, especially where we're having problems with things like waste management and so forth? One of my guests, I believe, is on with us now. Well, that's a relief because I was about to start singing show tunes. Jeff Stein is on the line with us. Jeff is an award-winning architect, writer, and educator. He's executive director of a program of program development and fundraising at Arco Santi, which is the experimental town just 70 miles north of Phoenix, Arizona, designed by Italian-American architect Paolo Soleri. Stein's first construction workshop at Arco Santi was in 1975. Since then, he has spent time on the staff, taught architecture in the Career Discovery Program of the Harvard Graduate School of Design, headed the Department of Architecture at Wentworth Institute in Boston, and was dean of the Boston Architectural College for the past 7 years. Jeff Stein, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And are you at Arco Santi today? Are you out there in Arizona?
I'm not, but I was there yesterday, and it remains as beautiful as ever, that landscape. If you're going to have to live through late fall and early winter, Arco Santi, Arizona is a really good place to be.
Well, as an aside here, I am actually retiring at the end of December and will be wintering in Apache Junction, which is on the southeast corner of Phoenix, so I won't be that far away. And now I definitely plan to come up and see what's going on up there at Arco Santi, because I'm fascinated by this topic. So let's start with learning a little bit about how Arco Santi came to be and the work of Paolo Soleri.
Well, Paolo Soleri, you're right. Born in Italy, Torino, Italy, 1919. He passed away just 3 years ago in April of 2013. Got a doctorate of architecture from the Torino Politecnico. It was in World War II. Had a really interesting life before coming to America, but he did come to America, and he came to Wisconsin, too. He studied with Frank Lloyd Wright at Taliesin in Wisconsin and Taliesin West in Scottsdale, Arizona, for a year and a half in 1947 and 1948. And his time with Wright sort of transformed his design attitudes and what he imagined was really possible. He had come from the post-war Italian economy. All of Europe was just decimated by World War II, to come to America, and he's a great American success story, Paolo Soleri is, an immigrant coming to this country after World War II with nothing much except some really good skills and some big ideas, and he became one of the most renowned and interesting architects, urban planners, theorists of the 20th century.
And take us to Arco Santi. It's north of Phoenix. What does it look like? How does it function?
Well, Arco Santi is kind of a base camp for arcology. Arcology, one of Paolo Soleri's skills was to be able to mash up English words and architecture and ecology as two parts of a whole system is what Arco Santi is intending to demonstrate, and at a very small scale does that even now. It's a series of interconnected buildings and spaces, and all of the buildings sort of open in one way or another to the south. You know, in the history of art and architecture, the thing that has been most important to portray in art and architecture has been the human body. It gets abstracted. And you know, all of our sensory organs, eyes, nose, mouth, they're on one side. There's a front and a back to us. And Soleri imagined that there needed to be a front and a back to buildings, too. And it wasn't just that the front faces the street and the back is in an alley, but in the Northern Hemisphere, the front faces south and the low winter sun. And so these are buildings whose forms shade themselves and the people in them in the summertime when the sun is really high in the sky, and then the earth tilts on its axis, and the buildings gain light and heat in the wintertime when you need it the most. So when We have about 50,000 visitors a year at Argosanti, people who come to the Southwest and need to see what's been going on at Argosanti. And when they come, most of them have heard that Argosanti may be the birthplace of the sustainability movement here in America, 1970, the same year as the first Earth Day and a few other things that were going on back then when the culture, frankly, was so much different than it is now. But the first question is always, where are all your solar panels? And, of course, we do have some solar panels, but sustainability isn't really just about energy use, although it is about that. It's about a number of things, but mostly what happens at Argosanti is that our buildings work harder than yours do, and so we only use about a fifth of the electricity that most commercial or residential places use. Just because we have plenty of sunlight for daylighting, the buildings pretty much heat themselves in the wintertime from the low winter sun, and they cool themselves because of the shade they cast in the summertime. And so we're trying to understand where we are, that is, around the Earth. And there are cold months and there are hot months, and most architecture, and in fact, In the history of architecture recently, especially in the 20th century, most architects really didn't pay attention to the fact that they're on Earth and there are these changes of seasons. And so, you know, in Wisconsin, we pump millions of BTUs of fossil fuels into buildings just so we can be in them in the wintertime. And then, oh, shoot, it's hot in the summer and we have to pump more millions of BTUs in to make them habitable in the summertime to cool them off enough. But at Argosanti, two things happen. We don't do that, and because the buildings are in shapes that just work better with the natural landscape, and also our comfort level is a little broader than yours, perhaps. And so if we get a little warm, we take off some clothes, or if it's a little chilly in the office on a winter day, we put on our down vest, and there we go.
My father was fond of saying that in the wintertime, you can put on as many layers of clothing as you like, but in the summer, there's only so much they'll let you take off.
Yes, that's true. And while we're not exactly prudish at Argosanti, we do have our limits. And so, there's only so much you can take off.
Mm-hmm. Backing up the telescope a little bit, taking a little bit broader view beyond Argosanti, the whole the ideas that Soleri was talking about in the late 60s and the early 70s, they found some adherence, and not just in Arizona. There are arcologies being built in a number of places around the world. What's your awareness of this? I mean, how big a movement is this, and is this something that we can expect to see growing as we face more and more problems related to the kinds of structures we put on the Earth and how we live in them?
Yes, I think that we will see more of this. It looks like it's inevitable. Soleri started Argosanti not because he wanted to be a cult leader or even because he thought he had the answer to anything, but he wanted to see if this notion of compact, complex, three-dimensional, single structure, neighborhoods, towns, cities, could be the answer to something. And as we continue building Argosanti, and as there's more and more media attention, publications, films about the work there, it looks as if maybe we're onto something. And so others in other countries, China, in Hamburg, Germany, Higgins and DeMella have just built their city in a box, which was hugely expensive, but it's organized around a symphony hall and multi-use. There are residences, apartments, recreation, stores, shops, learning facilities, all together in a single place. Soleri took a really broad view of this notion, and with the help of some other thinkers and evolutionary biologists, began to imagine that cities are the newest life form on the planet. That is, even humans are walking cities. You know, we're comprised of 10,000 times more bacterial cells than human cells, and they're walking around on us. All of these things can be found on their own out in the landscape, not doing much. But when they get together in the design of the human body, fabulous things happen. It could be William Shakespeare or Frederick Chopin or Donald Trump. Anything can happen in this form. And so we imagine that just because cities are so new, only 7 to 10,000 years old, they just haven't been designed properly. They've been designed cheaply, and in fact, most cities have been designed for short-term profits by real estate brokers and not by anybody that knows anything about evolutionary biology or even what the needs are of the natural systems of the planet. And so when we begin to confront this thin film of life that is urban sprawl and imagine that it could be collected and made three-dimensional and much more interesting and more fun, that's a big change in the way we organize our pattern of inhabitation on the planet. But it looks more and more like it's inevitable, and it's the coming thing, and we might not see too much of it in our lifetimes, but our children and grandchildren are certainly going to. And, of course, depending on how fast you think climate change is going to rise sea levels, there are going to be plenty of opportunities to build new towns, new places to live, reorganize our pattern of inhabitation of the whole planet.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have more with Jeff Stein, who is executive director at Arcosanti, which is an arcology that's being built in Arizona, just a little north of Phoenix. When we come back, I understand Arcosanti is a work in progress. I'd like to hear kind of where you are with that and what you're looking forward to with Arcosanti as you move on to the next stage in its development. 800-642-1234. If you have questions for Jeff Stein about arcology and about Arcosanti, this would be a great time to call. 800-642-1234. Email address is talk@wpr.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This hour on the Kathleen Dunn Show, we're talking about arcology. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. My guest in this segment, we'll just have him for a few more minutes, is Jeff Stein, Executive Director at Arcosanti. And Jeff, Arcosanti, a work in progress, started in 1970. It's still being built. Where are you, and what do you hope to do next?
Well, we're still in the very early stages of the place. There are about 80 people only who live there year-round, even though there are thousands of people who visit annually, and there are some 7,000 people who have participated in educational construction workshops over the past 45 years, who have actually built the place. So we're an educational resource to a dozen different colleges and universities, mostly in the U.S., but in Europe and Japan as well. And we are the headquarters for a joint degree in sustainable design and construction with the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, Scotland. And so they send students to us on a regular basis, and we're making some inroads into how the next generation of designers and builders think about making towns and cities, and also how the next generation of transportation designers might think about it as well. The issue for us is not driverless cars, but it's not needing cars at all. When you talk about sustainability and the word cars come up, those two things are pretty much antithetical to each other. And so we're working in that way as well. Mm-hmm. Arcosanti is a center for the performing arts in the Southwest and the middle of Arizona, and that's key, really, to understanding urban life as we're trying to model it at Arcosanti. The most complex place that we have so far at Arcosanti is what we call the East Crescent. It's on the east side of the construction site, and it is a performing arts amphitheater, an outdoor theater with a fabric roof, and then the back wall of it, instead of being box seats, is residences, apartments. There's a library, dormitories, and classrooms for our own students, and so the back wall is lived in, and it's thickened up, so it's regular apartment size. And beyond that is the natural world. And so the issue for our ecology is it's not enough just to live downtown, but to be in touch with the patterns of nature that 10,000 generations of humans have co-evolved with is also a pretty important issue for us. We recently had a film crew from Canadian television at Arcosanti filming a program about nature deficit disorder among young children in the United States and Canada and Europe. Kids who, for the most part, don't get outside. They get all their information from flat screens indoors, surrounded by four walls and a ceiling and floor. And they imagined that Arcosanti might have an answer to that issue. And we think we do, too. So if you live in the East Crescent, you go out your back door, you're in the natural landscape right away. You go out your front door, you're in the cultural landscape. And some of the most extraordinary of human events go on there on a regular basis. So rather than crowding houses, places where people live, up against noisy, dangerous carbon monoxide and car-filled streets, I mean, really, whoever thought that was a really good idea? instead, we have them forming the back wall of a performing arts amphitheater, and it's really fantastic. My own apartment is in that complex, and it's just terrific to be in touch on a daily basis with artists who are performing right on your doorstep. Anyway, we hope to continue to construct more places for people to live. There are overnight guest rooms for people to stay in who are not exactly a part of the work of the community, but it's possible to visit the place, and there's a cafe and a number of interesting little amenities, but we hope to expand it so more people can have the experience of this kind of complex and really delightful existence.
So if somebody wanted to get in touch and find out more about Arcosanti, how would they do that?
The best way is to just go online to the Arcosanti website, arcosanti.org, and have a look. And that leads you, once you're on the website, to a number of telephones and ways to be in touch with people there or part of a network of alumni who are all over the world.
Well, like I say, I'm headed out to Arizona in right around the new year. And
Good. We look forward to seeing you out there, and some of your Wisconsin listeners too.
Well, there are plenty of them actually that winter out there now. So maybe I'll bring some friends. Thank you so much, Jeff Stein, for joining me in this half of the program and for talking about what's going on at Arcosanti and the whole idea of arcology. A pleasure to talk to you.
You're welcome. The pleasure's been mine. Thank you.
Jeff Stein is the executive director at Arcos Santé, and thanks to him for joining us on the Kathleen Dunn Show. And now we're joined by Peter Head, who is the CEO of the Ecological Sequestration Trust. And he joins us now as we continue our conversation about arcology. Peter Head, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show. Appreciate you joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to talk to you and your listeners.
Well, we're learning about a whole new way to think about building and living based on the idea of the arcology, that's at least a launching point. Let's start this segment. Let's learn a little bit more about your organization, the Ecological Sequestration Trust. Outline for us what it is and what it aims to do.
Yes, well, I created that. It's actually what we call in the UK a charity, so it's a charitable organization. I guess you call it a not-for-profit. And basically, I'm a civil engineer, structural engineer, and a city planner. And I got a little bit fed up with the fact that we didn't understand the economics of looking after the environment and living in different ways that we're about to discuss. So I created this charity 5 years ago to create planning and investment tools to enable us to fashion a way of living which is much more resilient than the one we have at the moment, and at the same time create jobs and create a better quality of life for people. So we're basically building rather complicated computer software that regions and communities can enter data into and start planning and attracting investment for new ways of living new ways of looking after the environment, new ways of farming, new ways of forestry and so on. So it's a pretty ambitious program, but a lot of people around the world are very excited about it.
How does this fit into the concept of arcology?
Well, basically, it's about the way we live. It's about the density of the way we live. It's about our mobility. It's about getting the right food, the right resources, water, energy, and so on. And, of course, one of the things we're beginning to explore is whether we should do this in higher density situations in ways which are more efficient in the use of resources, because at the moment, every person on the planet's using rather more resources than we've got available on average across the planet. So we're beginning to consider whether, in fact, we can do this in a much more resource-efficient way, an energy-efficient way, and a more resilient way as a result. And so arcology was born a very long time ago now in concept, but I think it's very relevant for our current situation. I have to say, actually, that talking about it in the context of the USA is perhaps slightly odd for me, because the USA has a much lower population density than any other country in the world, virtually, and therefore you have an awful lot of land available, whereas we don't have that in Europe, and they certainly don't have it in China. So it's a slightly different situation for you, I think.
Well, and that may not be a real huge advantage. It is a different situation, but when the population is all spread out, it's also creates some efficiency issues, I would think.
Yes, it does, actually. And because I study global infrastructure and investment requirements for infrastructure globally, one of the things that I tell people is actually when you have a very low population density, the investment costs and the maintenance costs for infrastructure between your urban centers is going to be a lot higher. I estimate it's probably 4 or 5 times higher than it is in Europe and China and Asia, which, of course, may explain why the U.S. has got rather a big backlog on looking after its freeways and bridges and so on, because it's more expensive.
There's a lot of infrastructure out there that needs to be maintained. Let's talk about the program about the problem from maybe a more global perspective. Just how bad are things in the cities around the world?
Well, basically, there are sort of three big problems. One is that urbanization is still not complete. Obviously, in the U.S., urbanization is quite high. I mean, the proportion of population living in cities and urban areas is quite high. But other countries like India and Indonesia, and still in China, urbanization is still continuing. So actually, this requires a huge amount of infrastructure investment. And the problem is that as the population of the world has grown, we've only got about a quarter of the land available to support this process than we had 100 years ago when the a bit less than that when the US did its urbanization. So actually, the materials we need for this are getting more and more expensive, and are stressing the planet because we're having to exploit resources in more difficult locations that actually destroy the ecology, and of course at the same time we have pollution and air quality problems, water quality problems, sanitation problems. So actually there's a massive set of problems which the UN and others have decided to try and tackle, but they need to be tackled in ways that we haven't done before, because actually we don't have the resources that we used to have to do it. So we have to sort of take a right-hand turn into a much more resource efficient way of thinking, which is why the ecology idea is really interesting.
Well, and if you combine the concepts of climate change, population density, and resource scarcity, in 2016, that almost 2017 now, that tends to suggest that there's a great deal more urgency to developing some new ways of thinking, just based on the fact that we may be running out of time. Back in 2008, the Guardian newspaper named you one of 50 people who could save the planet. Are you and your methods truly capable of such a tall order?
Well, I certainly wouldn't claim that, but I've been trying to live up to that that billing a bit, to try and build to create the tools to enable people to be very innovative and to do things differently, and the only way we can really do that is to use a systems approach, and maybe I can give a couple of examples of that, because
that'd be good.
A bit grand, but let me give you a systems approach example. Well, one of the big problems that we have is that cities, when they need food and resources, energy and water and so on, tend to take a lot of those resources from rural areas. And rural areas tend to be stripped of carbon, stripped of other things. You know, nothing comes back. Everything the cities take a lot away from rural areas, and they don't give anything back. And that is creating a sort of stress problem. So the idea of actually closing the resource loop between urban and rural systems by recycling carbon and nutrients and other things, in other words, recycling wastewater, nutrients and other things back into the farm system, you know, so that soils get carbonized and so on. You know, that sort of idea is a very powerful systems idea, which can actually help to rebalance the prosperity in urban and rural communities. So actually, there's a lot of ideas like that, which are not simply looking at cities on their own, but looking at everything as a system, providing us with food, energy, and water, and so on. Mm-hmm. And by those sorts of efficiencies, we can begin to reduce costs and improve the, you know, closing the gap between the rich people in the cities who tend to have more investments looking after them, and people in rural communities who get rather less.
800-64 go ahead.
So really what we're doing is developing tools that enable those new solutions to be found, and also to attract capital to invest in them, because actually if they save money, then you can invest in them and make money out of those savings.
800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's take a call before we go to our next break. We'll go to Watertown, and Annie is on the phone. Annie, thanks for joining us on the Kathleen Dunn Show today.
Hi, this is Greg. It's from the UK, because I think the term comes from that. I was wondering if he was familiar with Bobbyology, a Bobbyologist, a term that I heard, people seem to be very unfamiliar with it, and I just was wondering if this has something to do with that.
Bobbyology,
actually.
That's a new one. That is also a new one to me, and I thought I had a rather large vocabulary, but apparently it needs to grow yet. Annie, what can you tell us about Bobbyology?
It was older English books from the 50s, 60s. Maybe older, and talking about like fake walls, the whole heat, and things like that. And that's how they referred to it, was B-A-U-B, Bobbyology, of a way of making your homes more energy efficient. So that's all.
Interesting. Okay.
All right. Okay. Well, I've not heard of that, but certainly energy efficiency in homes is a very, very important subject in relation to solving some of these problems, that's for sure.
Well, this is public radio. We're supposed to be learning new things every day, so I'll mark that one down. Bobbyology. I'll have to look into that. We're talking with Peter Head, who's the CEO of the Ecological Sequestration Trust. Arcology was kind of our launching point this afternoon, which was a term I discovered in a piece of science fiction, which is how a lot of people maybe come to the whole idea of cities of the future and things like that as we imagine what might be. And then can we make it real? That becomes the question. Peter, when we come back, maybe we can talk a little bit about how we transfer or translate or something, how we get from what we can imagine to actually getting something built, particularly considering the sort of social inertia which seems to possess us as human beings so often. And we'll take some more of your calls as well. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This hour on the Kathleen Dunn Show, we're talking about arcology, the marriage of architecture and ecology. And my guest in this segment is Peter Head, CEO of the Ecological Sequestration Trust. It's a good thing I'm retiring. I've apparently forgotten how to talk. And we're discussing about what can be done and what new technologies could help us out if we had the will to actually implement them, and how we might use different technologies in different ways, different kinds of computer programs to do analysis, help us figure out the best way forward and how to make our cities sustainable, because it's clear that we have some problems and they need to be dealt with fairly quickly, or they'll just keep getting bigger. So the conditions that we're talking about, sometimes, you know, we see them amplified and employed in science fiction with visions of dystopias and things in the future where we didn't solve these problems and now things have gotten even worse. But the problems are real and we're facing them today. Sometimes it seems like there's a question of whether life is imitating art or vice versa. Can we look at science fiction and actually see what our future might be? And do we have some choices we can make today that would avoid some of those darker predictions?
Yeah, my view of this is actually, of course, we start from where we are. We don't start from some different place. And where we are needs to be evolved into where we want to go. And it seems very unlikely to me that we're going to sort of evolve into some completely different world from a fairly developed country like the US, for example. So I think it's much more about using technology to completely change the performance of our homes, of our mobility systems, of our energy supply systems. So actually the look of it may not be so different, but I think the way it performs will be greatly different, which means it will cost less and be more efficient and enable a higher quality of life with reduced pollution and so on. So my view generally is that we're likely to evolve in those ways rather than in completely refashioning the built environment, which of course is going to be hugely expensive to do compared with the things I mentioned at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, give you a simple example for that. There's a lot of work now going on in turning homes and buildings into power stations. So instead of having to use lots of electricity and heating and so on, they can actually use the sun and use batteries and heat storage and so on to actually enable buildings to not have any net costs over the annual cycle. Obviously, in Wisconsin, that may be slightly more difficult because you have very cold winters. But in principle, around the world, this is likely to be a way that we go. Just as a simple example of a big change that really is quite a game changer for energy supply systems. That's just one example.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We have a whole bunch of people who suddenly have an interest in this topic, and I'd like to get to as many of these calls as we can. We'll start in Slinger, where Paul is with us. Paul, thanks for joining us on the Kathleen Dunn Show today.
Hi, good afternoon. You know, with Homo sapiens, the more multiplicity you have in living patterns, whether it's a room or building or town or city, the more it comes to life and the more dynamic it will be. And I'd like to have this gentleman just discuss briefly. There's three books. One's called The Oregon Experiment. The other one's called The Timeless Way of Building. And the last one is A Pattern Language, Towns, Buildings, and Construction. And they're a collaborative effort, but the lead person was Christopher Alexander, which I think are three brilliant books on the evolution of cities and making them both compatible with nature and livable for the intellectual human being on this planet. I just wondered what his thoughts were.
Yes, no, I'm aware of that work, and I think it is very important work. And I think the benefits that we now have is we're now able to sort of model the human and ecological systems activity and actually improve even further on those solutions. So I think, you know, I think they're a great starting point. And I think now, because we've got the ability to model these things so much better and more accurately, we can now find our way to even more exciting outcomes than that. And we can retrofit our way towards them, you know, rather than having to rebuild everything and start again. Mm-hmm. So, but I think the examples you quoted are really important as a starting point for that. And there have been some great thinkers in this area all the way through, actually, but we haven't always delivered on them, as I think your previous discussion was all about. You know, we tend to have created pollution and all sorts of things that we didn't really want.
Yes, Paul, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Wayne, who's joining us from Three Lakes. Wayne, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thank you very much. I find this topic very interesting, but I would like your present guest's opinion about your previous guest's statements and community. This was in this Arizona community was designed to house 3,000 people. It was begun 45 years ago, and in 45 years' time, they've managed to get the population up to 80 people, and it was designed for 3,000. Why would we not consider this a failed experiment, and what lessons do we learn from it? And I'll take my answer offline. Thank you.
Wayne, thanks for the call. Why hasn't this whole concept of arcology taken off a little more?
It's a really good question. I think partly it's an economics problem. There have been a number of experiments like this. There is another one in India at a place called Auroville, where they were trying to do something similar. And actually, a lot of the problem comes down to economics and jobs and earning power and investment power within the community. That's my experience anyway. One needs a certain critical mass to actually be able to invest in the scale of the infrastructure that arcology requires. And I think people often underestimate the power of or the lack of power of that process. And obviously, it's a chicken and egg problem that you can't build up that investment power without people. But obviously, if you haven't got the people, you can't do it. So in my view, that's part of the problem.
Mm-hmm. And maybe there's a uniquely American problem here as well, which is over the last 50 years, we've seen a lot of agitation against what's called collectivism, that the idea of, you know, we're rugged individuals here in the good old USA, and we do things independently, and the idea of working collectively is actually anathema to some people. Maybe that's a uniquely American problem. I guess I'd have to say I don't know.
It's a really interesting point, because actually all the analysis we've done of the journey we need to make to create a more resilient society globally does require cross-sectoral collaboration. And collaboration requires a certain humility and a certain humbleness. And I think there is a problem there, because obviously businesses and business people tend to be creating empires. And although they may talk about collaboration, it's actually very hard to do, because you've got to be rather humble in the process of collaboration and sharing and so on. Mm-hmm. And I do think we're not very good at it. And that is sort of getting in the way of the next stage of evolution, I think.
Let's take another call. We'll go to Winona, and Chris is on the line. Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Hi. I'll try to make this quick. I'd just like to commend the guest for so well stating the problem in current America, and it's probably a problem this current election defined between rural and urban areas, that there's this one-way street between for that resources go, and they leave rural areas and go to urban areas. And those resources aren't replaced. Now, I don't think that's necessarily why what happened, but, you know, I think it's all a part of it. And the way he linked it to environmentalism is and sustainability, spot on. Great job.
Thanks. Thanks for the call, Chris. Well, kudos to you, Peter Head, for nailing Chris's point for him.
No, thanks. And not only that, but actually there is a way of reversing it, and there is a way of investing in reversing it, which I think could be a way forward, actually, with the new administration to actually, you know, reverse that problem and help to sort of heal some of those obvious hurting wounds of which have come about through the election.
Let's take a quick call from Wanda, who calls us from Wausau, Wisconsin today. Wanda, hello.
Hi. Yes, this is very interesting. My brother moved to Arizona a few years back, and he just blows my mind the way he thinks outside the box. He's off the grid. He's, you know, put up pools to collect water during the raining season. He's built a greenhouse, and the walls of the greenhouse is made out of tires filled with sand. He's put black water barrels in there to collect the heat that will keep plants warm in the evening. You know, he found a solar, you know, those big discs do you remember the old big discs for TV?
Yes.
He got one of those, and he put solar panels on it. So it will move from in the morning. It sets itself up in the morning. It's facing east, and then as the sun sets, it goes west. And then at night, it rotates back to collect it in the it's just crazy what he's come up with. And it's just amazing. And I told him, if the world ever ends, I'm coming to live with him.
Okay. And well, Wanda, thanks so much. But there are people who have been able to live off the grid with greater or lesser success. We've got about a little over a minute left in the program, Peter Head. I'd like you to maybe do some predicting, and that's always a dangerous thing. But talk about what you see happening, say, in the next 20 to 50 years.
Well, basically, I think basically we are going to move to a sort of integrated systems approach. And I think actually a lot of the capital in the world we can draw into changing the way we live into a more resilient fashion, both by retrofitting and building arcology-type solutions. So I think this might be a solution to the finance problem, but also a solution to narrowing the gap between the rich and the poor and helping poor people get jobs and actually live a better quality of life.
And if we want to find out more about the Ecological Sequestration Trust, how can we do that?
You can do it on the website, which is ecosequestrust.org. And what I would suggest anyone does is go and look for Roadmap 2030, which actually is this roadmap for how we might get from here to 2030 in better shape.
Okay. Peter Head, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. Appreciate your time.
It's been a great pleasure.
Peter Head is CEO of the Ecological Sequestration Trust. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this show, KP Whaley for on-air production. Coming up tomorrow at this time, we'll talk about the mental health of college students. Campuses across the country are reporting that their students are increasingly relying on mental health centers. A pair of experts weigh in on this trend. That's tomorrow at 2 o'clock on The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks so much for joining me this afternoon. Kathleen will be back next week, I believe. And I'll be doing something else, cleaning my office, I think. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today and tomorrow on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.